Well, good morning and welcome, everyone, to Live Dharma Sunday for October 23rd, 2011. I'm Reverend Koyo Kubota, your host. So glad you joined us. Well, this time of year in the Central Valley, which is the agricultural center of the world, they grow more fruits and vegetables. And this time of year, it's the season for kaki, which in Japanese means persimmon. And, of course, there's two kinds, the fuyu, which is the sort of the pumpkin-shaped, and it's sort of like an apple. You eat it when it's still crunchy. Then there's the hachiya, which is more pear-shaped. It also starts out hard, but you can't eat it. You have to wait until it gets soft and sweet. Those hachiya persimmons is very sour if you try to eat it before it's ripe. So it gets soft. But what you could also do when you first pick them and they're still hard is you could peel the skin off with a knife, and then you can hang them to dry in the sun. And after a couple of weeks, they become very sort of like dried fruit, you know. And it's a very traditional dried kaki, dried persimmon, and it's a delicious treat. And then you even momu, or that means massage, the drying persimmons. You know, they start to get softer, and you massage them, and it brings out the sugar to the surface. That's what they say. And then when it dries, it forms a nice white coat, very characteristic white coat on the surface of the persimmon. And it's dried persimmons are a big treat. Or, as I said, you could wait until it gets soft. Maybe it takes over a week or so. And then that sourness turns very sweet. It's quite an experience to bite into a green. Now, it's not green. It could look orange on the outside, but it's an unripe hachiya persimmon. It's so sour, it'll pucker your mouth. You do it once and you'll never do it again because it's really unique, very powerful, strong sensation. And another reason I'm talking about this is that it's because of that sourness that later leads to the sweetness. Without that sour characteristic, you know, you won't have that persimmon. So in a way, we could say that sweetness comes from the sourness. When the sourness matures and is transformed, it's the basis or source of the sweetness. And isn't that a Dharma teaching, where in Buddhism there's the saying that misfortune is fortune, and vice versa too? What does it mean? Misfortune is fortune. Or sometimes my father had an article that he called "Black is White." Something that's black in one circumstances or time or person can become white. A personal misfortune later on becomes the basis, the source of some treasure that one has received in life. Okay? Without that hardship, okay, failure is the source of success. You might think that somebody that achieves something or, you know, does something great or has good fortune. Ah, lucky guy. But he may have gone through a lot of difficulties, suffered a lot of setbacks. You don't see that. Maybe that's not apparent or not shared. So I always think about that in cocky season, in the sour relationship between sour and sweet. Okay. And we don't have to seek out the sour just because we think, oh, okay, that's going to lead to the sweet. Life does this for us. Okay. And indeed, it says in a crisis, there's great danger, but there's also opportunity. And so we can't discount the danger, that is the emotional upset and the negative strong feelings. But at the same time, we should realize that there's an opportunity for new growth. Okay? Not in spite of the danger and difficulties, but because of them. You would not have seen those opportunities if you were not subjected to that kind of dire straits. So it is indeed a good Dharma teaching. Well, today we're going to have a special guest for our Dharma glimpse. I'm looking at him right now. He's our new dog, a new puppy, 15-week-old golden retriever. And his name is Raku, R-A-K-U. Raku, Adrian named him. Raku means, in Japanese, means easy. And of course, as you may know, our yellow lab, who's almost four years old, is named Easy. And he has his own truck, a white Chevy pickup with the license plates Easy K9 on it, with the backdrop of a license plate of Yosemite National Park license plate. That's Easy's truck. Goes all over. He's a number one helper. And now we got an additional member of the family, little Raku. And they play together a lot. And Raku, he's going to give the Dharma glimpse today. Raku? Wow, wow. Wow, 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 wow. Wow, 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 wow. Wow, wow, wow. Well, thank you, Raku. They sure pay attention. They came running. Both of them came running when that Dharma glimpse was airing. And they're looking with big eyes. Well, maybe I ought to, since some of you don't understand dog, I'll translate. Raku says that he's very happy, you know, when he spent about a week now, he came, and when we first took him away from his litter mates and owner, you know, he's sort of like he stepped off the edge of the world. He came into a new place, and he had a lot to learn. There was a lot of firsts. But he said that he appreciates the new home. He appreciates the good home that he came from. And his mother was Abigail. We saw the mother. And there were 9 pups, all male. And of course, Raku chose us, and so we brought him home. And he says, he's very innocent, but he's also worldly in that his mother taught him something. He said one time the mother and the pups were out walking. Their home was on a 17-acre lot in Korsgold. And there was this, they were just walking along, mother dog and the pups, and this ferocious, wild bobcat came out. And the mother dog didn't know what to do, so she said, "Meow, meow." And that startled the bobcat, and he ran away. And then she turned to her pups and said, "See, it pays to be bilingual." And this also could work in other situations where if it's a mother cat taking her kittens for a walk and a big old ferocious dog comes into view, the mother cat doesn't know what to do. She goes, "Bow wow." And she could turn to her kittens and say, "Yes, indeed, it helps to be bilingual." Well, thank you very much, Raku-san, for a nice Dharma glimpse. And to be bilingual doesn't necessarily mean knowing another foreign language, per se. But I take this as to be a Dharma message because knowing another language means knowing another way of understanding things. It's another way of sort of being spiritual in a secular world. You know, a different mindset, a different attitude. How to live an absolute life in a relative world. It's how to be able to know both languages, the languages of one's own spirituality and the one language of functioning in a dualistic environment. Okay. Sure helps to be bilingual. And I was thinking about the Buddha. When you read about his life, biography of his life, we don't know how accurate or anything it is, but it's really not the point, the historical accuracy. But anyway, a lot of the stories say, you know, as he traveled around and he met people, he would interact with somebody and have an exchange with them, very brief, and bam, the person's enlightened. The Buddha knew how to communicate. He knew, you could say a master psychologist in a way. He knew, in order to know how to communicate, you have to really understand the other person. The other person, you don't talk from a lofty place down to the level of somebody else. If you're a great teacher, you can talk to their experience, to their world, from where they're coming from. That's a tremendous teacher. That's a tremendous, what we would call, in Buddhism, they call it upaya, which means skillful means. The Buddha somehow could really know the motivation of somebody who understood, you know, if he was talking to a farmer, he's talking to a businessman, and he was very skillful in communicating, right to the point. So I kind of joke, and I say, "Gee, you know, if the Buddha was talking to a dog, he'd go bow wow. He talked to a cat, he'd go meow meow, and he could communicate. He's the ultimate dog or cat whisperer. They listen." So maybe it was not too much of an exaggeration that in a brief meeting with he would transform people's lives. So we have to do that in our own lives. Not only dealing with others, but with ourselves in terms of how we see the world. Can we use skillful means? Can we understand other people? And this reminds me of, you know, Kurosawa, the famous Japanese film director. One of his famous big early hits was Rashomon. If you're familiar with that movie, it's a classic story of a bandit who ambushes a samurai traveling with his wife in the woods. And he kills the samurai, he rapes the wife, and he's caught. And at his trial, you know, they're saying, well, what happened? And everybody had a different story about what happened. The bandit justified his situation and that the wife really wanted to leave her mean samurai husband and made a play for him and all of this stuff, and, you know. And the wife, she told a different story. And they threw a medium, they brought back the spirit of the samurai, and he told a completely different story. And then there was a woodcutter who was hiding in the woods and witnessed it, and he gave another different story. Four different stories of the same event. That was sort of the psychological moral of this movie. That what is truth? What is reality? Well, it all depends upon the observer. They see their own... we don't see reality the way it is. We see the world the way we are. It always goes through our filters, our personal needs and fears and, you know, greed, whatever. And I always will remember... At one time, I went to a dermatologist, the University of Illinois Medical School, and saw Dr. Solomon, who, no pun intended, he was very wise. First time to meet him, and we sat in the little examining room. 45 minutes he talked to me. Doctors usually are very quick and fast, but he talked, you know, he said, oh, you're Japanese in background? And I said, yes. And he talked about his trips to Japan and everything. And he mentioned that Rashomon was one of the movies that changed his life when he was a young medical student, because it taught him that when he sees his patients, to understand them as individuals and to see, put himself in his patient's place so that he could really understand where they're coming from and be a better doctor for it because of Rashomon. And he gave us several other examples too of his, you know, teachings that he learned. Okay. But I always remember that. That was really something. And it's true. In fact, in psychology, you know, personality theories and so forth, there's a school called phenomenology. You have to understand the other person's phenomenal world. You really want to be a good therapist. You want to understand that person. You know? And one example I remember reading in a textbook that talked about the phenomenological approach, really appreciating where the other person is coming from, without saying, "Oh, I'm the therapist, or I know better, or, you know, this is what you should do." No, wait a minute. Okay. One example given was there was a preschooler, and he was very quiet, inhibited, shy. So, you know, social skills were, you know, very limited. And the parents were concerned, so they called us psychiatrists to come. And they told the psychiatrist the problem. He seemed like he's always a loner and everything. He doesn't, and so the preschooler was sitting in the backyard, sitting in the grass, and so the psychiatrist said, "Well, okay, I understand what you've told me. I'm going to go observe him myself and, you know, see." So he went outside and was watching the child, and he had a notebook and was making notes, observing the child. And he noticed the child took a stick and found a worm, and he cut the worm in half with the stick. And the psychiatrist said, "Ooh, kind of destructive, violent," and he was writing down, you know, these tendencies, reflecting some hostility and antisocial behavior, sort of, maybe. And then he was still walking closer to the child. And then he got close enough to overhear the child saying, "There, now you have a friend." This is an example of where we could easily misinterpret where someone's coming from. You know, if you don't really understand the person, but you bring your own judgments and interpretation. Okay. So I always think of that phenomenology as the same point that the Rosh Ramon movie is making. And I remember seeing at a Sarah Center, which was a Catholic retreat center in Malibu. I was there for a interfaith retreat once, and it's a Franciscan monk order run place. And of course, Franciscan means Saint Francis of Assisi, and his very classic prayer. And part of it goes, "May I love rather than be loved. May I understand rather than be understood," you know, and so forth down the line. But the relevant one here would be, yeah, "May I understand others," rather than always trying to say, "Oh, why don't you understand me? Why don't you understand me?" You know? Okay. You have to be the one that understands. This is a very good point, because I think most of us, in our usual language, in our usual way of looking at things, we want to be understood. We want to be loved. We want to, you know. Whereas the real joy and compassion and richness of life is the loving others, understanding of others. And this, in a sense, is very pragmatic, makes sense. Because, see, if you're the wise one, then, yeah, we should be the understanding one then. Yeah, even in the world of greed, even in the world of anger, we're the giving and kind ones. Because we have right understanding. Because we know. Because we're bilingual. It's sort of like a motorboat, you know, in maritime laws, when you're on the water, the watercraft that's the most nimble yields the right of way. It's not like somebody says, "Oh, I got the right of way. I'm just going to go." But maybe if it's a sailboat, it's not quite so nimble. Or if it's a ocean liner, they're not too agile, you know. But a small motorboat, zip, zip, zip. Okay, he can get out of the way, move around. And so the stronger one yields, the flexible one yields. Of course, the ego self might say, Hey, why is that? How come I always have to be the one that gives in? No, it's not like have to, should, or obligation. You just naturally do this. You see, this is tremendous upaya and skillful means. You know, Kannon Bodhisattva, they sometimes call the goddess of mercy. I don't know if that's the best translation. Avalokitesvara, many names for Kannon. And sometimes he or she is depicted as many arms, 10,000 arms for this bodhisattva, this helping Buddha. Why does 10,000 arms? You know, well, if it's a real statue, maybe it's a couple of dozen arms. You'll notice in each palm of each hand, there's a different, well, you might call it a tool, a different spiritual tool. Because Kannon, goddess of mercy, feels compassion for the whole world. And in order to actualize that compassion, put it into action, Kannon is the epitome of upaya, skillful means to help all humanity. Okay, whatever it takes. All kind of tools. And indeed, we could stock up our spiritual toolbox with all kinds of tools, all kinds of situations, all kinds of people, okay? All kind of people we'll meet, all kind of situations we'll personally face. All kind of tragedies, and we need that upaya, we need to be bilingual. And in fact, it has been said that all religion is upaya. Sometimes you get caught in a trap that says, oh, I think, you know, what's true or not or whatever, but hey, all of religion is upaya. Trying to help people, human beings. So we could understand this in a very broad way, and it comes right down to us to be bilingual, as Raku would say, to understand others, to have harmony with others and peace within. There it is. Well, that's all for today's broadcast. Till next time, you keep going, and you have a very beautiful Bow Wow Day. Thank you.